In our first lecture on benzene, we discussed quite a bit of molecular orbital theory, and I'll again summarize what went on in that lecture because it's kind of the core of this chapter. This stability that we get because of forming a ring, allowing a fully conjugated system to become a ring, which in some cases, like in benzene's case, ends up being favorable, and in some cases, like cyclobutadiene, ends up being unfavorable. Part of the evidence of benzene having this favorability is the fact that all the carbon-carbon bonds in benzene are equal in length, which it's kind of showing how everything's being drawn together, versus in cyclobutadiene, whereby having the double bonds interact, it creates higher energy electrons, so then the molecule distorts to try to avoid that. Then on Tuesday, we kind of continued that topic, saw some more examples of both aromatic and anti-aromatic molecules. We saw the cyclooctatetraene system, which, remember, that's the one that exists kind of in a boat shape, because if it were planar, it would be anti-aromatic. You again would have higher energy electrons. We saw the cyclopentadienyl anion and how that's an example of delocalization of something that on paper looks like it's just an sp3 hybridized carbon. So it's just yet another example of how resonance structures fail to match reality. We saw the, what was the other one we did? We did some examples of molecules that are aromatic and are not aromatic. So we saw pyridine, we saw pyrrole, we saw naphthalene, we saw the trick problem with the two hydrogens that were repelling each other, did we not? Did I do the one that's boron, nitrogen? Then before I do a new topic, there are a couple example molecules that I hadn't shown you yet. One the other section saw, and one nobody's seen, so you'll get to be the first. One of those is this one. Which, before you start writing, look carefully. How many sides? 7, yes, which is wonderful joy when you're first learning it, because then you got to figure out, okay, how do you count? Can you consistently draw a 7-sided figure? This compound, is it aromatic? Because that was also part of Tuesday's lecture, these Hugo rules. Well, what are the rules? It's, okay, and is it cyclic? Yes, of course. Is it planar? Yeah. In this case, it should be planar. Everything should be planar because most of it is sp2 hybridized. But is every position on the ring sp2 hybridized? No, we have one sp3 hybridized carbon that doesn't have a lone pair. It has hydrogens. And so it is not aromatic. Because the sp3 hybridized carbon blocks conjugation. Blocks full conjugation. This system does have conjugation. It's a triene. It's a conjugated triene. So it'll have some stability because of the fact that you have conjugation, but you won't have aromaticity. But this is a very unusual molecule because, unlike the cyclopentadiene system that we saw that was unusually acidic, this is an unusual source of the hydride ion. And this is the cyclohepta-1,3,5-trienyl anion, or it's also called the tropylium ion, the short name. For the astute in the class, you must realize that if I'm showing this example, there must be a reason for it. And part of that reason is to ask, why is this a source of hydride? Why would this be favorable? But don't answer that out loud, because this is a mini, mini, mini homework problem. Because I want you to take the time to draw a frost circle and prove why this is a very favorable reaction. Favorable enough, at least, that with a strong enough Lewis acid, it can induce that hydride to dissociate. So there's one example. Now let's do... yes, this one. This is the compound azulene. For those of you good at languages, what color is this compound? Blue. It's organic, but it's blue in color. If it's blue in color, what wavelength of light, roughly, does it absorb? I couldn't quite hear you. It's red, orange, somewhere in there. If you don't remember your Chem 1C, you might remember that there's a color wheel, that what is absorbed is different than what we perceive. So this compound has enough conjugation, though, that it's able to absorb in the red end of the spectrum, which is what gives it its blue color. Enough conjugation? How much conjugation? Is it aromatic? It's kind of identical to naphthalene, in a sense, other than the fact that we have two unequal rings, a 7-member ring and a 5-member ring. But yes, it's aromatic. It's cyclic. Every position's conjugated. There is no steric hindrance because there's an actual bond between the two halves. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pi bonds, which means 10 electrons. And so if n equals 2, it would fit 4n plus 2. What kind of shape would we inscribe in a circle in order to make a frost circle for this molecule? What sort of shape would we use to inscribe in a circle were we to want to construct a frost circle for this molecule? That it's not the question I was asking. It is a decagon. Why? There are 10 atoms that are part of the ring system. So if you remember the rules for writing a frost circle, one point of that polygon that you inscribe has to be at the bottom, and the number of points total is the number of atoms in the ring. Since this is a 10-atom ring, if you ignore the bond in between, we would inscribe a decagon. We would not inscribe this shape. And so that's why I made the point when I went over what a frost circle is, of saying the way I did, how do you determine what polygon you use? So yes, this is aromatic. Because it is planar, cyclic, conjugated, and 10 pi electrons. And I'll just put in parentheses, decagon for frost circle. And actually, the first molecule I wrote is this exact type of example I was going to show next. So I'll just use that in this section as our example. I wanted to give you a system where it looks like most of the ring is conjugated except for one position. And because that one position doesn't have a lone pair but instead just has hydrogens, that means that it has no orbital available to do conjugation, which is why it's not aromatic. So questions about either of these two examples before I move on to the real topic I wanted to get into today. All right, well, then let's get into that topic. because I wanted to talk about another form of evidence of the stability of benzene. And the way we're going to do it in this case is by reactivity. Specifically, we're going to compare three different hydrogenation reactions. So we learned about hydrogenation last quarter. It's where you just add H2 to a double bond. And before I even write anything on paper, I'll ask this two ways. How could you calculate to figure out whether hydrogenation is thermodynamically favorable? What I mean by that is exothermic. Why would you expect that hydrogenation would be exothermic? The first part of the question is, if we had hydrogenation of an alkene, I could tell you, for example, cyclohexene being hydrogenated is a negative 120 kilojoules per mole. Yes, you need to know that number. Yes. Flip that around. Would it cost more energy to break the pi bond than the energy released once we do make the new carbon-hydrogen bonds? There'd be one more thing to add into that, the cost of breaking the hydrogen-hydrogen bond itself. So that's the answer to the first part of the question, that if we compare breaking the carbon-carbon double bond to make a single bond, breaking the hydrogen-hydrogen bond to get the two hydrogens, and then creating two new carbon-hydrogen bonds. Why might you guess that it should be exothermic? What's the difference between a sigma and a pi bond? Which one tends to have more orbital overlap? Sigma bond. Because a sigma bond, you have orbitals that are directly pointed to each other. Pi bond, you only have the sideways interaction. That's why generally, not always, a pi bond by itself, just the breaking of the pi portion of the bond, is easier than breaking a sigma bond. I mean, think about reactions of alkenes. Alkenes react, alkenes don't. And that right there shows you some difference in the reactivity of carbon-carbon double versus single bonds. When we hydrogenate, we create these sigma bonds, that there is good overlap, which means there is more energy released. So that isn't really important to what I'm about to show you, but it's just a little bit of review of some fundamental chemical reactivity. The reason I want to show you these hydrogenation reactions is look what happens if we take, instead of cyclohexene, we take cyclohexa-1,3-diene. Notice we end up with the exact same product. That's going to be useful because that will allow us to have a common basis of comparison. Because technically, if you're going to use the word stable, which we are, which I already did, stability technically can only be rigorously compared between isomers. And cyclohexene and cyclohexadiene are not isomers. However, they end up forming the same product. And so we have some right to make some comparison between these different reactions. What would you guess? Would be the approximate heat of reaction. Negative 60. Half. But you have two double bonds, right? Instead of just one? So 240, you might guess, because if one double bond released 120, then two double bonds being hydrogenated, you might guess, would release 240. But it turns out the real value is 208. Why? times one, I'm sorry, that's sloppy. Carbon-carbon bond. So if one carbon bond was 120, that's why I'm saying that we would guess that two carbon-carbon double bonds would be 240, but it's not. And you were giving an answer why. It's not what kind of bonds get formed, actually. Yes, it is because of conjugation. The conjugation, remember that lowest energy molecular orbital has a sharing of electron density all the way across a molecule, whereas if you had just a double bond, it's localized. So you have more electrons being shared overall in the conjugated system, and so that causes the difference in energy. And this is a way experimentally to say that this molecule to begin with is more stable. Because if it releases less energy when it reacts, that means it was already at lower energy to begin with. In fact, let me write down exactly that sentence, because that's kind of the crux of the argument being made here. Something, if you're comparing reactions, and one reaction releases less energy than the other, then what we're going to say then is that one compound started at lower energy than the other. So, I don't know what the real value is, but we could go up and look. I could try to find somehow cyclohexane-1,4-diene. That's a non-conjugated system that has two double bonds. I bet you if I looked it up, it would be right around negative 240. Then we really, really, really could make a firm comparison. And the one on the right would be more stable. Because, again, let me write this as I say it. Cyclohexa-1,3-diene would be more stable, which means lower energy, than cyclohexa-1,4-diene. Since less energy would be released in the reaction with the 1,3-diene, meaning it was lower in energy to begin with. Now, since there's just enough room over here, let me squeeze in one last reaction. And I wrote up here that the difference in the previous case was due to conjugation, but let me just write out that the difference itself is 32 kilojoules per mole, or 12.5% roughly of the expected value, theoretically. Now let's look at benzene. And we'll do the same thing, because you know where this has got to be going. That we're going to make a comparison between the actual and the theoretical values for the hydrogenation of benzene. On the theoretical side, we'll say 3 times the hydrogenation of one carbon-carbon double bond is likely to be similar to what it should be. But we don't just have conjugation, we have aromaticity. And I know I kept saying over and over again that aromaticity is like a souped-up form of conjugation. How much? Oh, dear. Well, this book doesn't have all the numbers it should. I'm going to have to go change the number, and I'm going to have to look it up real quick. Darn. No, I wasn't looking closely enough. It only compares the single alkene with the benzene. It doesn't have the two double bond case. It is actually, I thought that number looked familiar, negative 208 for benzene itself, which means that the difference in energy is huge. 152 kilojoules per mole. More than the energy of just hydrogenating a double bond. I'll go back in after class and fill in the correct number for the diene case, because I know every other OChem textbook I've got's gotten that in there. I don't know why this book wouldn't. But actually, I need to draw a graph, so if you'll forgive me for a moment, let me see if I can find it online. Okay, well, I'll just do the drawing, and like I said, after class, I'll fill it in with the correct numbers. Because here's the graph that's made. Yes, that's awfully darn close to 240, but it might be just that little amount. Maybe conjugation isn't that much of a stabilizer. You found it online? So let me go refer to the text. I know exactly where to look for it. I just don't want to waste more time to go find it. So notice that because in all three cases I'm making cyclohexane, that the three bottoms of these three portions of the graph are all in line with each other. Then I have the negative 120, the negative 240, and negative 360 to show the real and theoretical hydrogenation values for 1, 2, and 3 double bonds. I then show the actual heats of hydrogenation and showing that there's a difference between the actual and the theoretical. The difference is due to the stabilization either because of conjugation for the diene or because of aromaticity for benzene. So, supremely classical explanation or demonstration of the stability of benzene. And I'll just tell you, one of your problems, you have to regurgitate almost exactly this graph and be able to explain it. A question I ask every year. I have to stop this habit of writing the test in front of you all. It's not like you're complaining, I know, but still.
Don't stop now?
Okay.
That's supposed to be
H2RH2. Yes, thank you.
Water on the brain.
Questions? Since we've had 2.5 days now of wow, benzene is special, maybe we should start talking about how benzene reacts. Some mechanism and some synthesis, maybe?
Oh, dear.
It is because of this extra special stability that benzene has that it does not react with most of the reagents an alkene would. That doesn't mean it won't react. That means we need to use a different set of reagents. We have to use a set of pretty strong reagents. What we do with benzene is, well, the easiest thing is something called electrophilic aromatic substitution. What does electrophile mean? Now, why is it just this front row that's participating? Is it just the front row that's going to take the exam later? Then what's wrong with the rest of you all? What's an electrophile? No. I want the rest of the answer. Electrophile is seeking positive charge. No, that's nucleophile. Nucleophile seeks positive charge. I know what you were thinking, because if you think back to SN2, the nucleophile is called a nucleophile because it wants to seek positive charge, which is why nucleophiles are usually negative charge, and then they'll go attack the delta positive centers. An electrophile means it wants electrons. And if we use an electrophile and throw it at benzene, that's what's going to force benzene to react. So, in general, I'll say E plus to represent the electrophile. The double bond will open up. Later on, maybe go back and look at this in terms of reaction coordinate diagram. And what we're going to find is a huge activation energy. Because you're getting rid of aromaticity. You're going to go from this aromatic benzene to a conjugated but non-aromatic intermediate. So notice there's 5 carbons now that are sp2 hybridized, and so it's conjugated, but you don't have aromaticity. But what if after the electrophile reacts, there's something in solution that could act as a base? Now in these reactions, when I say base, it doesn't mean basic, it just means something that could provide electrons.
So let's say we have some kind of base. We need to label what these E's and B's are. Well, it can remove that hydrogen, which should be very, very, very favorable for it to do, because once it does so, it can reform the double bond, and you get benzene again. Except now that you got, now you have a substituent on it. And so that's why it's electrophilic aromatic substitution. You add the electrophile, get rid of hydrogen. That's the general mechanism, but we need to see some examples of this. Shall we? Rough crowd. Nitric acid, before I write it, write a Lewis dot structure for it. No, that's not just talking out loud. You all get your pencils out, figure out the Lewis dot structure of nitric acid. Neutron, I don't see a pencil in your hand. That's better. Now, paper in front of you would do wonderful with that pencil. There you go. Take out your crayons and your paper. What's that? Yes, yes. One of my favorite t-shirts for a while was the one that says, runs with scissors. Do we have it yet? Do I have to send you all back to Chem 1A again? Yes. I must have already done this form of a soapbox speech, but if I hadn't, this is for your own good. How many of you remember how to do buffers? How many of you remember the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation? How many of you are taking biochem? Oh. Okay, for those of you who started to raise your hands or even think about it, before you get there, read up on buffers, read up on the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Because depending on how it's taught, you'll be doing buffer calculations all day long. Because if you're trying to study mechanism, you're trying to talk about what happens at a certain pH, biological pH, well, those various pH values you can make by creating different buffer solutions. So in real life, when you're doing assays or whatever, you have different pHs, which means you have to know how to make those buffers. So I know this is an off-topic thing, but one of the things I hear from all of you all who run off to Davis and San Diego or wherever else for your biochem, it's a lot of acid-base chemistry, pKa's and half equivalence points and titrations and buffers and all that. Not to make you so, oh, look at the foo-foo face now. But it's better that you know what you're getting into before you get there, right? Lewis dot structure of nitric acid. If you wrote this, remember nitrogen can't be pentavalent. Nitrogen can't violate the octet rule by going over. So the structure of nitric acid is this. Now, what do you think would happen if we took nitric acid and add sulfuric acid? Can one acid neutralize the other? But there will be some kind of reaction. What's the only thing logically that might happen? Okay, we could put a hydrogen on the O minus, potentially. Or, what if we did this? Because now, water can leave as a leaving group. we get this cation, which you might think would be a very unfavorable cation to form, because you're having to take nitric acid and turn it into a base, force that water to come off. But in strong enough conditions, this is exactly what can happen. And that NO2 then would be the perfect type of thing to try to force benzene to react. And so the next thing that happens, benzene reacts. And then the water that came off can provide the electron to pull the hydrogen off to remake benzene, and we make nitrobenzene. Oh, I've just realized, since we're just now starting really talking about benzene, benzene compounds, benzene-related compounds, we should do some nomenclature. Wow. That gasp of joy, I don't know if I could handle that, you know? That's a lot of pressure on me now. When you put one methyl group on benzene, it is called toluene, which other than fluorine, it's one of the most misspelt or at least mispronounced words. Kind of like if you listen to one of our former presidents who used to say nuclear, right? Instead of nuclear, nuclear. A lot of people say toluene. I don't even know what you say, but if I try to do it, I start going, toluene is the right way. If you put a second methyl group on it, you all have used that molecule before. What is it? Well, you didn't actually use this molecule. You used a mixture of three of them. Xylene, that's right. This is meta-xylene, ortho-xylene, meta-xylene, and para-xylene. If we put an alcohol group on there, it becomes phenol. If we put a methoxy group on there, it becomes anisole, which, yes, is related to anise, the seed that's got the licorice flavor or smell to it. If we put an aldehyde on it, I know you've seen this name before, but just to be systematic, Benz aldehyde. If we, I know there's a couple other good ones, hold on. Oh, of course, how could I forget that? Put a double bond on it. Styrene. If you put a carbonyl on it, then this portion of a molecule is known as a phenone. And this compound specifically is acetophenone. I think that's enough names for now. 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Good enough. Well, okay, no. A couple more examples, because these are common names. And you gotta know how to make a systematic name. So, priority-wise, in terms of nomenclature, would I label this compound to give a 1 to the methyl group or the propyl group? Because this could be called propyl-methyl-benzene or methyl-propyl-benzene. Which way would it be called? Propyl-methyl-benzene, because P, no. Methyl-propyl-benzene, because M comes before P, correct? The reason this comes up, or I'm asking this question, is because we can make the propyl 1 to make the methyl 3, or we can make the methyl 1 and the propyl 3. We have to decide one way to do it, when there's a tie like that. And when there's a tie, the one that comes first alphabetically wins. So this is 1-methyl-3-propyl-benzene. Or it's also called meta-1-methyl-3-propyl-benzene. And again, when there's a tie, when in numbering a compound, the first substituent alphabetically gets the lower number. I think we're a little low on time. I think I got one more reaction I have time to tell you about. Yeah. So we'll do one more reaction for today. And it's actually a pair of reactions. We'll only just do one of the two today. Very, very widely known reaction called the Friedel-Crafts reaction. There's a Friedel-Crafts alkylation, there's a Friedel-Crafts acylation. I'm going to talk about the acylation first because it's a slightly simpler reaction. So when you have a compound with a carbonyl, the carbonyl with one of the groups attached, if it's an alkyl group, it's called an acyl group. And if we have a halogen also attached to the carbonyl, that is called an acyl halide. It's actually classified as a carboxylic acid derivative. And next quarter you'll learn how to make acyl halides. For the moment, you just need to know what one is. And we'll take a specific one for our example here. The common name of this is acetyl chloride. Which will not react with benzene directly. It is a very reactive compound, reacts with water to make acetic acid and hydrochloric acid. I'll back that up, I'll say it again. It reacts with water to make hydrochloric acid, to make acetic acid. I point this out because you're going to use this compound next quarter, so anticipate I'm going to lecture all again once more about leaving bottles open. Because I've been seeing it happen again. I just haven't yelled about it again yet. But that means that you'd be sitting around the room breathing in hydrochloric acid, which I don't think that most of you would want to do. How can we make this react? Well, we use a very strong Lewis acid. Aluminum trichloride. Also a compound that if it sits around with water, it will form hydrochloric acid. If you put the two together, the following occurs. Aluminum trichloride lacks an octet. It's not as reactive as borane, but it's still hot stuff. So the chloride from an acyl halide can donate into the aluminum. Which makes a complex which can decompose either by the aluminum popping back off again, or aluminum is a good enough Lewis acid, it likes to hold on to the chlorine, that it can cause the carbonyl chlorine bond to break to make what's in general known as an acylium ion. So acyl, that's that acyl group. Acylium means positively charged, so acylium ion. Extremely electrophilic. So now this will break the benzene ring open. The rest of this is the same as we had for nitration, which is actually the same for almost all these benzene reactions. That once we have the electrophile, it reacts with benzene. And then a second follow-up step, something comes along to pull the hydrogen off to reform benzene. One common mistake when writing these mechanisms, because after you practice this a few times, it's not actually that bad a mechanism, it's pretty short. But the common mistake is, where do you put the plus charge, where do you put the hydrogen after benzene initially reacts? And so notice that the plus charge is not where the electrophile goes. Wherever the electrophile goes, there's another hydrogen there already. So when it makes the bond to the electrophile, no charge. But because the ring did open, whatever carbon didn't get the electrophile does get the positive charge. Questions about that reaction? This is what? This is acylation, yes. And we call it acylation because we're adding an acyl group. Any questions? Then I'm going to save free of perhaps alkylation until next time because we need to discuss a side reaction that ends up occurring. But we'll do that tomorrow.